powers of control to publicity about the trial. From the very inception of the proceedings, the judge announced that neither he nor anyone else could restrict prejudicial news accounts, and he reiterated this view on numerous occasions. The court should have made some effort to control the release of leads, information, and gossip to the press by police officers, witnesses, and the counsel for both sides. And it is obvious that the judge should have further sought to alleviate this problem by imposing control over the statements made by the news media, by counsel, witnesses, and especially the coroner and police officers. More specifically, the trial court might well have prescribed extrajudicial statements by any lawyer, party, witness, or court official which involves prejudicial matters, such as the refusal of Shepherd to submit to interrogation or to take any lie detector test. Any statement made by Shepherd to officials, the identity of prospective witnesses or their probable testimony, any belief in guilt of innocence or like statements concerning the merits of the case, cited cases, in which the court interpreted Canon 20 of the American Bar Association's Canons of Professional Ethics to prohibit such statements. Being advised of the great public interest in the case, the mass coverage of the press, and the potential prejudicial impact of publicity, the court could also have requested the appropriate city and county officials to promulgate a regulation with respect to dissemination of information about the case of their employees, who parenthetically, I would say, are citizens under the First Amendment. In addition, reporters who wrote or broadcast prejudicial stories could have been warned as to the impropriety of publishing material not introduced in the proceedings. Parenthetically, again, I would say that was done, and actual knowledge of those orders was disseminated and actually delivered physically to the two respondents. The judge was put on notice of such events by defense counsel's complaint about the WHK broadcast on the second day of trial. In this manner, Shepherd's rights to a free trial from outside interference would have been given added protection without corresponding curtailment of the news media. Had the judge, the other officers of the court, and the police placed the interest of justice first, the news media would have soon learned to be content with the task of reporting the case as it unfolded in the courtroom and not pieced together from extrajudicial statements. But we must remember that reversals are palliatives. The cure lies in those remedial remedies that will prevent the prejudice at its inception. The courts must take such steps by rule and regulation that will protect their processes from prejudicial outside interferences. Neither prosecutors, counsel for defense, the accused, witnesses, court staff, nor enforcement officers coming under the jurisdiction of the court should be permitted to frustrate its function. Collaboration between counsel and the press as to information affecting the fairness of a criminal trial is not only subject to regulation, but is highly censurable and worthy of disciplinary measures. Now, Your Honor put into effect this very elaborate system of safeguards that is evidenced by these orders. I believe that Your Honor will be reassured that he did the right thing, in that in September of this year, the Judicial Conference of the United States, which is composed of all of the federal judges and certainly invited selected members of the bar, made a representation to the Supreme Court of the United States to invoke the rulemaking power. And Your Honor, if Your Honor, when and if Your Honor has an opportunity to read that report, which runs some 55 or 60 pages, will find that every recommendation that was made by the Judicial Conference is in one of the orders of this court. Now, I'm not going to pursue this constitutional matter any further unless it's necessary and I'm gonna switch gears just a little bit. And for the purpose of argument, I am going to assume that my premise play is right, and that there is some special license. And that this, as to his class, can be overturned as a void order. That, in my opinion, is a perfectly ridiculous assumption, but I make it for the purpose of argument. Even so, the posture of the case would not be affected in any way. It is the duty of everybody within the jurisdiction of the court who has knowledge of the orders of the court from any source to punctually, faithfully, and fully obey those orders. The same point was made, or arose, in the Supreme Court of Tennessee in National Corporation against United Steelworkers, 187 Tennessee, 444. That was a case where there was some pretty rough picketing going on, and there was an injunction to limit the number of the pickets and to restrain them from acts of violence. There was a citation for violation of that injunction. The respondents came in and made exactly the same argument, saying picketing is an expression of the right of free speech, and we have that right to exercise it unqualified. Well, the court ruled that they did not, that it, like every right, is a qualified right, and as Mr. Justice Holmes so well and succinctly stated, that the right of free speech does not give one the right to shout fire in the middle of an opera house. But the Supreme Court of Tennessee said, we therefore conclude that the injunction as issued did not violate the constitutional rights of these appellants, and that the petition for contempt fully and fairly apprised them of their alleged acts in violation of said injunction. What I would say, regardless of whether or not the injunction was irregular or erroneous, it must, while it continued in force, be obeyed, citing authorities. In a note to the above-quoted statement, numerous cases are cited as authority therefore, citing three cases, which are to the same effect. The obvious reason for this almost unanimous holding is stated by Chancellor Gibson as follows. Now, this was written, if Your Honor please, over 100 years ago in the magnificent language that this man knew how to use. The power to punish for contempt is one of the highest prerogatives of the Court of Justice. Upon its bold and prudent exercise depend the respect, the dignity, and the efficiency of courts as arbiters of human rights. The mandates of the Court of Chancery must in all cases be obeyed according to the spirit of the decree, promptly, faithfully, and without question or evasion. The party upon whom the order or command of the court operates is not allowed to speculate upon the equity of the bill or the legality or regularity of the order or decree or of the writ issued thereon. But his simple duty is to obey. And when he disobeys, it is the duty the court owes to itself and the public to punish him at once. Now, recently, that has been before the Supreme Court of the United States in what was essentially a very hard case. This was a case that arose from some marching down in Birmingham, and I'm not sure about it. It's only interesting, and maybe it is just a coincidence, and only slightly interesting. It's true that I believe our friend was the mayor.
Absolutely, yes, sir.
And there was an injunction issued against certain parades. And it's perfectly clear that had the question of the legality of that order been tested, the refusal to give a license and the injunction against it, that those people probably would have been given the right to parade. had challenged it in the Alabama courts and had been met with delay or frustration of their constitutional claims. But there is no showing that such would have been the fate of the timely motion to modify or dissolve the injunction. There was an interval of 2 days between the issuance of the injunction and the Good Friday March. The petitioners gave absolutely no explanation of why they did not make some application to the state court during that period. The injunction had issued ex parte. If the court had been presented with petitioners' contentions, it might well have dissolved, or at least modified its order in some respects. If it had not done so, Alabama procedure would have provided for an expedited process of appellate review. It cannot be presumed that the Alabama courts would have ignored the petitioner's constitutional claims. Indeed, these contentions were accepted in another case by an Alabama appellate court that struck down on direct review the conviction under this very ordinance of one of these same petitioners. The rule of law upon which the Alabama courts relied in this case was one firmly established by a previous precedent. We do not deal here, therefore, with a situation where a state court has followed a regular past practice of entertaining claims in a given procedural mode and without notice has abandoned that practice to the detriment of the litigant who finds his claim foreclosed by a novel procedural bar. This is not a case where a procedural requirement has been sprung upon an unwary litigant when prior practice did not give him a fair notice of his existence. The Alabama Supreme Court has never, in any criminal contempt case, entertained a claim of non-jurisdictional error. And then they go on and cite the rule of the Supreme Court of Alabama, which is essentially the same as that stated in the Steelworkers case. The rule of law that Alabama followed in this case reflects a belief that in the fair administration of justice, no man can be the judge of his own case, however exalted his station, however righteous his motives, and irrespective of his race, color, politics, or religion. This court, this is the Supreme Court of the United States speaking, cannot hold that the petitioners were constitutionally free to ignore all the procedures of the law and carry that battle to the streets. One may sympathize with the petitioner's impatient commitment in their cause, but respect for judicial process is a small price to pay for the civilizing hand of law, which alone can give abiding meaning to constitutional freedom. So I say that Mr. Clay is wrong that the newspapers have any constitutional license that exceeds the right to speak freely. And I say that even if it was so, it would not have altered the posture of the case, and that if these reporters or either of them wish to go outside the orders of the court, they should, by their competent and able counsel, come into this court and presented that case and asked for relief, which they did not do. It's my belief that since the constitutional basis is unsound, that they would not have obtained the release, but they would have at least shown a greater desire than it is now apparent to honor the lawful office of this court. Only one other point that I want to make, and I'm not sure that that is in this case, but it may be. That is,